There are moments in life when only sharp physical action can heal the wounded spirit. Just as a native of India, stung by a scorpion, will seek to relieve his agony by running, so now did Lord Tilbury, fresh from this scene with one who seemed to him well fitted to be classified as a human scorpion, desire to calm himself with a brisk cross-country walk. Reaching the broad front steps and seeing before him the station taxi, he was conscious of a feeling amounting almost to nausea at the thought of climbing into its mildew-scented interior and riding back to the Emsworth Arms. He produced money, thrust it upon the surprised Robinson, mumbled unintelligently, and turning abruptly, began to stump off in a westerly direction. Robinson, having pursued him with a solid, silent, Shropshire stare till he'd vanished behind a shrubbery, threw in his clutch and drove pensively homewards. Lord Tilbury stumped on, busy with his thoughts. At first chaotic, these began gradually to take shape. His mind returned to that project which had been conceived while standing alone in the small library. A single object seemed to be imprinted on his retina, that desk in which the Honourable Galahad had placed his manuscript. He yearned for direct action against that desk. Like all reformed buccaneers, he put up a good case for himself in extenuation of this resurgence of the old Adam. To take that manuscript, he argued, would merely be to take that which was rightfully his. He had a legal claim to it. The contract had been signed and witnessed. Payment in advance had changed hands. Normally, no doubt, as between author and publisher, the author would have wrapped his work in brown paper, stuck stamps on it, and posted it. But if the eccentric fellow preferred to leave it in a desk for the publisher to come and fetch it, the thing still remained a legitimate business transaction. And how simple the looting of that desk would be, he felt, if only he was staying in the house. From the careless, casual way in which the Honourable Galahad had put the manuscript in that drawer, he had received a strong impression that he would not even bother to lock it. Anybody staying in the house? Bitter remorse swept over Lord Tilbury as he strode broodingly through the heat-hushed grounds of Blandings Castle. He saw now what a mistake he'd made in taking that proud, offended attitude with the Honourable Galahad. If only he'd played his cards properly, taken the thing with a smile, accepted that invitation to dinner, and gone on playing his cards properly, he would almost certainly, before nightfall, have been asked to move his belongings from the Emsworth Arms and come and stay at the castle. And then, of all sad words of tongue or pen, the saddest are these, it might have been. Groaning in spirit, Lord Tilbury walked on. And suddenly, as he walked on, there came to his nostrils the only scent in the world which could have diverted his mind from that which weighed it. He had smelt a pig. To those superficially acquainted with them, it would have seemed incredible that George, Viscount Tilbury, and Clarence, Earl of Emsworth, could have possessed a single taste in common. The souls of the two men, one would have said, lay poles apart, and yet such was the remarkable fact. Widely though their temperaments differed in every other respect, they were both pig-minded. In his little country place in Buckinghamshire, whither he was wont to retire for recuperating over the weekends, Lord Tilbury kept pigs. He not only kept pigs, but loved and was proud of them. And anything to do with pigs, such as a grunt, a gollop, or, as in this case, a smell, touched an immediate chord in him. So now he came out of his reverie with a start, to find that his aimless wanderings had brought him to within potato-peel throw of a handsomely appointed sty. And in this sty stood a pig of such quality as he had never seen before. The afternoon, as has been said, was overcast. An unwholesome blight, like a premature twilight, had fallen upon the world. But it needed more than a little poorness of visibility to hide the Empress. Sunshine would have brought out her opulent curves more starkly, perhaps, but even seen through this grey murk, she was quite impressive enough to draw Lord Tilbury to her as with a lasso. He hurried forward and stood gazing breathlessly. His initial reaction to the spectacle was a feeling of sick envy, a horrible, aching covetousness. That was the effect the first view of the Empress of Blandings always had on visiting fanciers. They came, saw, gasped, and went away unhappy, discontented men, ever after to move through life, bemused and yearning for they knew not what, like men kissed by goddesses in dreams. Until this moment, Lord Tilbury had looked on his own Buckingham big boy as considerable pig. He felt now, with a pang, that it would be an insult to the supreme animal before him even to think of Buckingham Big Boy in her presence. The Empress, after a single brief but courteous glance at this newcomer, had returned to the business which had been occupying her at the moment of Lord Tilbury's arrival. She pressed her nose against the lowest rail of the sty and snuffled moodily. And Lord Tilbury, looking down, saw that a portion of her afternoon meal, in the shape of an appetizing potato, had been dislodged from the main couvert and rolled out of bounds. It was this that was causing the silver medalist's distress and despondency. Like all prize pigs who take their career seriously, Empress of Blandings hated to miss anything that might be eaten and converted into firm flesh. Lord Tilbury's pig-loving heart was touched. Envy left him, swept away on the tide of a nobler emotion. All that was best and humanist in him came to the surface. He clicked his tongue sympathetically. His build made it unpleasant for him to stoop, but he did not hesitate. At the cost of a momentary feeling of suffocation, he secured the potato, and he was on the point of dropping it into the Empress's upturned mouth when there occurred a startling interruption. Hot breath fanned his cheek. A hoarse voice in his ear said, "Arr!" A sinewy hand closed vice-like about his wrist, another attached itself to his collar, and, jerked violently away, he found himself looking into the accusing eyes of a tall, thin, scraggy man in overalls. It was the time of day when most of nature's children take the afternoon sleep, but James Pirbright had not slept. His employer had instructed him to lurk, and he had been lurking ever since lunch. Sooner or later, Lord Emsworth had told him, quoting that second-sighted man, the Honourable Galahad Threepwood, there would come sneaking to the Empress's sty a mysterious stranger. And here he was, complete with poisoned potato, and Pirbright had got him. The Pirbrights, like the Canadian Mounted Police, always got their man. "Grr," said James Pirbright, which is Shropshire for, "you come along with me, and I'll shut you up somewhere while I go and inform his lordship of what has occurred." Monty Bodkin, meanwhile, after parting from Sue on the roof, had been making his way slowly and pensively through the grounds in the direction of the Empress's headquarters. It was his intention to look in on the noble animal and try to do himself a bit of good by fraternizing with it. He was not hurrying. The afternoon was too hot for that. Shropshire had become a Turkish bath. The sky seemed to press down like a poultice. Butterflies had ceased to flutter, and as he dragged himself along, it was only the younger and more sprightly rabbits that had the energy to move out of his path. Yet even had the air been nipping and eager, it is probable that he would still have loitered, for his mind was heavy with care. He didn't like the look of things. No, mused Monty, he didn't like the look of things at all. Sheridan once wrote of a damned disinheriting countenance, and if Monty had ever read Sheridan, he would have felt that he had found the perfect description for the face of the 9th Earl of Emsworth as seen across the table in the big library or peering out from behind trees. Not even in that interview with Lord Tilbury in his office at the Mammoth had he been surer that he was not associating with a man who proposed very shortly to dispense with his services. The sack, it seemed to him, was hovering in the air. Almost he could hear the beating of its wings. He came droopingly to the paddock where the Empress resided. There was a sort of potting-shed place just inside the gate, and here he halted, using its surface to ignite the match which was to light the cigarette he so sorely needed. Yes, he felt, as he stood smoking there, if he had any power of reading faces, any skill whatever in interpreting the language of the human eye, his latest employer was on the eve of administering the bum's rush. It seemed to him that even now he could hear his voice crying, "Get out! Get out!" And then, as the sound persisted, he became aware that it was no dream voice that spoke, but an actual living voice, that it proceeded from the shed against which he was leaning, and that what it was saying was not "get out," but "let me out." He was both startled and intrigued. For a moment his mind toyed with the thought of spectres. Then he reflected, and very reasonably, that a ghost that had only to walk a quarter of a mile to find one of the oldest castles in England at its disposal would scarcely waste time in haunting potting sheds. There was a small window close to where he stood. Emboldened, he put his face to it. "Are you there?" he asked. It was a fair question, for the interior of the shed was an Egyptian blackness. Nevertheless, it appeared to annoy the captive. An explosive, "Caw!" came hurtling through the air, and Monty leapt a full 2 inches. The thing seemed incredible, but if a fellow was to trust the evidence of his senses, this unseen acquaintance was none other than...
"I say," he gasped, "that isn't Lord Tilbury by any chance, is it?"
"Who are you?"
"Bodkin speaking. Bodkin M. Monty Bodkin. You remember old Monty?"
It was plain that Lord Tilbury did, for he spoke with a familiar vigour.
"Then let me out, you miserable imbecile. What are you wasting time for?"
Monty was groping at the door.
"Righto," he said. "In one moment, there's a sort of wooden gadget that needs a bit of shifting. All right, done it. Out you pop. Upsy-daisy."
And with these words of encouragement, he removed the staple, and Lord Tilbury emerged snorting.
"Yeah, but I say,"
pleaded Monty after a few moments, anxious, like Goethe, for more light. This was one of the weirdest and most mysterious things that he had encountered in his puff, and it was apparently his companion's intention merely to stand and snort about it. Lord Tilbury found speech.
"It's an outrage."
"What is?"
"I shall have the fellow severely punished."
"What fellow?"
"I shall see Lord Emsworth about it immediately."
"About what?"
Briefly and with emotion, Lord Tilbury told his tale.
"I kept explaining to the man that if he had any doubts as to my social standing, your uncle, Sir Gregory Parslow, who I believe lives in this neighbourhood, would vouch for me."
Monty, who had been listening with a growing understanding, checking up each point in the narrative with a sagacious nod, felt compelled at this juncture to interrupt.
"My sainted aunt," he cried, "you say you offered the porker a spud, and then this chap grabbed you, and then you told him you were a friend of my Uncle Gregory, and now you're going to the castle to lodge a complaint with old man River?" "Don't do it," said Monty urgently. "Don't do it. Don't go anywhere near the castle, or they'll have you in irons before you can say, eh, what? You aren't on to the secret history of this place. There are wheels within wheels. Old Emsworth thinks Uncle Gregory is trying to assassinate his pig. You are caught in the act of giving it potatoes and announce that you're a pal of his. Why, dash it, they'll ship you off to Devil's Island without a trial."
Lord Tilbury stared, thinking once again how much he disliked this young man.
"What are you drivelling about?"
"Not drivelling. It's quite reasonable. Look at it from their point of view. If this pig drops out of the betting, my uncle's entry will win the silver medal at the show in a canter. Can you blame this fellow Purbright for looking a bit cross-eyed at a chap who comes creeping in and administering surreptitious potatoes and then gives Uncle Gregory as a reference? He probably thought that potato contained some little-known Asiatic poison."
"I never heard anything so absurd."
"Well, that's life," argued Monty. "And in any case, you can't get away from it that you're trespassing. Isn't there some law about being allowed to shoot trespassers on sight? Or is it burglars? No, I'm a liar. It's stray dogs when you catch them worrying sheep. Still, coming back to it, you are trespassing."
"I'm doing nothing of the kind. I've been paying a call at the castle."
The conversation had reached just the point towards which Monty had been hoping to direct it.
"Why? Now we're on the thing that's been baffling me. What are you doing in these parts at all? Why have you come here? Always glad to see you, of course," said Monty courteously.
Lord Tilbury appeared to resent this courtesy, and indeed it had smacked a little of the gracious seigneur making some uncouth intruder free of his estates.
"May I ask what you are doing here yourself?"
"Me?"
"If, as you say, Lord Emsworth is on such bad terms with Sir Gregory Parslow, I should have thought he would have objected to his nephew walking in his grounds."
"Ah, but you see, I'm his secretary."
"Why should the fact that you are your uncle's secretary..."
"Not my uncle's. Old Emsworth's. Pronouns are the devil, aren't they? You start saying he and his, and are breezing gaily along, and you suddenly find you've got everything all mixed up. That's life, too, if you look at it in the right way. No, I'm not my uncle's secretary. He hasn't got a secretary. I'm old Emsworth. I secured the post within 24 hours of your slinging me out of Tiny Tots." "Oh, yes, indeed," said Monty with airy nonchalance. "I very soon managed to get another job. Dear me, yes. A good man isn't long getting snapped up."
"You are Lord Emsworth's secretary?"
Lord Tilbury seemed to have difficulty in assimilating the information.
"You are living at the castle? You mean that you are actually living, residing at Blanding's castle?"
Monty, thinking swiftly, decided that that airy nonchalance of his had been a mistake. Well meant, but a blunder. The sounder policy here would be manly frankness. He believed in taking at the flood that tide in the affairs of men which, when so taken, leads on to fortune. It was imperative that he secure another situation before Lord Emsworth should apply the boot, and he could scarcely hope to find a more propitious occasion for approaching this particular employer of labour than when he had just released him from a smelly potting shed. He replied, accordingly, that for the nonce such was indeed the case. "But only," he went on candidly, "for the nonce. I don't mind telling you that I expect a shake-up shortly. I anticipate that before long I shall find myself once more at liberty. Nothing actually said, mind you, but all the signs pointing that way. So, if by any chance you're feeling that we might make a fresh start together, if you're willing to let the dead past bury its dead, if, in a word, you would consider overlooking that little unpleasantness we had and taking me back into the fold, I, on my side, can guarantee quick delivery. I should be able to report for duty almost immediately with a heart for any fate." Upon most men listening to this eloquent appeal, there might have crept a certain impatience. Lord Tilbury, however, listened to it as though to some grand, sweet song. Like Napoleon, he had had some lucky breaks in his life, but he could not recall one luckier than this, that he should have found in this young man before him a man who at one and the same time was living at Blandings Castle and wanted favours from him. There could have been no more ideal combination.
"So you wish to return to Tilbury House?"
"Definitely."
"You shall."
"Good egg."
"Provided..."
"Oh, golly, is there a catch?"
Lord Tilbury had fallen into a frowning silence. Now that the moment had arrived for putting into words the lawless scheme that was in his mind, he found a difficulty in selecting the words into which to put it.
"Provided what?" said Monty. "If you mean provided I exert the most watchful vigilance to prevent any more dubious matter creeping into the columns of Tiny Tots, have no uneasiness. Since the recent painful episode, I have become a changed man and am now thoroughly attuned to the aims and ideals of Tiny Tots. You can restore my hand to the tiller without a qualm."
"It has nothing to do with Tiny Tots." Lord Tilbury paused again. "There is something I wish you to do for me."
"A pleasure. Give it a name. Even unto half of my kingdom, I mean to say."
Well, here is the position in a nutshell. Lord Emsworth's brother, Galahad Threepwood, has written his reminiscences.
I know. I'll bet they're good, too. They should sell like hot cakes. Just the sort of book to fill a long-felt want. Grab it, is my advice.
"That," said Lord Tilbury, relieved at the swiftness with which the conversation had arrived at the vital issue, "is precisely what I want to do."
"Well, I'll tell you the procedure," said Monty helpfully. "You get a contract drawn up, and then you charge in on old Galley with your checkbook."
"The contract already exists. Mr. Threepwood signed it some time ago, giving the mammoth all rights to his book. He has now changed his mind and refuses to deliver the manuscript."
"Good Lord, why?"
"I do not know why."
"But the silly ass will be losing a packet."
"No doubt. His decision not to publish means also a loss of a considerable sum of money to myself. And so I consider that, the contract having been signed, I am legally entitled to the possession of the manuscript. I intend to take possession of it."
"You don't mean pinch it?"
"That, crudely, is what I mean."
"I say, you do live, don't you? But how?"
"Ah, there I would have to have the assistance of somebody who was actually in the house."
A bizarre idea occurred to Monty.
"You aren't suggesting that you want me to pinch it?"
"Precisely."
"Well, Lord love a duck," said Monty.
He stared in honest amazement.
"It would be the simplest of tasks," went on Lord Tilbury insinuatingly. "The manuscript is in the desk of a small room which I imagine is a sort of annex to the library. The drawer in which it is placed is not, unless I am very much mistaken, locked, and even if locked, it can readily be opened. You say you are anxious to return to my employment, so, well, think it over, my dear boy."
Monty was plucking feebly at the lapel of his coat. It was new stuff to him. What with being invited to become a sort of Napoleon of crime and hearing himself addressed as Lord Tilbury's dear boy, his head was swimming. Lord Tilbury, a judge of men, was aware that there are minds which adjust themselves less readily than others to new ideas. He was well content to allow an interval of time for this to sink in.
"I can assure you that if you come to me with that manuscript, I shall only be too delighted to restore you to your old position in Tilbury House."
Monty's aspect became a little less like that of a village idiot who had just been struck by a thunderbolt. A certain animation crept into his eye.
You will?
I will.
For a year, certain.
A year?
It must be for a year, positively guaranteed. You may remember me speaking about those wheels.
In spite of his anxiety to enroll this young man as his accomplice and set him to work as soon as possible, Lord Tilbury was conscious of a certain hesitation. Most employers of labour would have felt the same in his position. A year is a long time to have a Monty Bodkin on one's hands, and Lord Tilbury had been consoling himself with the reflection that, once the manuscript was in his possession, he could get rid of him in about a week.
A year, he said dubiously.
Or 12 months, said Monty, making a concession.
Lord Tilbury sighed.
Apparently the thing had to be done.
Very well.
You will take me on for a solid year.
If you make that stipulation.
You will be prepared to sign a letter, an agreement, a document to that effect if I draw it up?
Yes.
Then it's a deal. Shake hands on it.
Lord Tilbury preferred to omit this symbolic gesture.
Kindly put the thing through as soon as possible, he said coldly. I have no wish to remain indefinitely at a rustic inn.
Oh, I'll snap into it. What rustic inn, by the way? I ought to have your address.
The Emsworth Arms.
I know it well. Try their beer with a spot of gin in it. Warms the cockles. All right, then. Expect me there very shortly with manuscript under arm.
Goodbye, then, for the present.
Toodaloo till we meet again, said Monty cordially.
He watched Lord Tilbury disappear, then resumed his walk, immersed in roseate daydreams. This, he reflected, was a bit of all right. There were no traces in his mind now of the scruples and timidity which had given him that slightly sandbagged feeling when this proposition had first been sprung upon him. He felt bold and resolute. He intended to secure that manuscript if he had to use a meat axe. In the shimmering heat mist that lay along the grass, it seemed to him that he could see the lovely face of Gertrude Butterwick gazing at him with gentle encouragement, as if she were endeavouring to suggest that he could count on her support and approval in this enterprise. Almost he could have fancied that the ripple of a lonely little breeze which had lost its way in the alder bushes was her silvery voice whispering, "Go to it." Writers are creatures of moods. Too often, the merest twiddle of the tap is enough to stop the flow of inspiration. It was so with the Honourable Galahad Threepwood. His recent unpleasant scene with that acquaintance of his youth, the erstwhile Stinker Pike, had been brief in actual count of time, but it had left him in a frame of mind uncongenial to the resumption of his literary work. He was a kindly man, and it irked him to be disobliging even to the Stinker Pikes of this world. To send poor Stinker off with a flea in his ear was not, of course, the same as rebuffing, say, dear old Plug Basham or good old Freddy Potts, but it was quite enough to upset a man who always liked to do the decent thing by everyone and hated to say no to the meanest of God's creatures. After Lord Tilbury's departure, the Honourable Galahad allowed the manuscript of his life work to remain in its drawer. With no heart for further polishing and pruning, he heaved a rueful sigh, selected a detective novel from his shelf, and left the room. Having paused in the hall to ring the bell and instruct Beach, who answered it, to bring him a whiskey and soda out onto the lawn, he made his way to his favourite retreat beneath the big cedar.
"Oh, and Beach," he said, when the butler arrived with clinking tray. "Sorry to trouble you, but I wonder if you'd mind leaping up to the small library and fetching me my reading glasses. I forgot them. You'll find them on the desk."
"No trouble at all, Mr. Galahad," said the butler affably. "Is there anything else you require?"
"You haven't seen Miss Brown anywhere?"
"No, Mr. Galahad. Miss Brown was taking the air on the terrace shortly after luncheon, but I have not seen her since."
"All right, then. Just the reading glasses."
Addressing himself to the task of restoring his ruffled nerves, the Honourable Galahad had swallowed perhaps a third of the contents of the long tumbler when he observed the butler returning.
"What on earth have you got there, Beach?" he asked.
For the other seemed heavily laden for a man who had been sent to fetch a pair of tortoiseshell-rimmed spectacles.
"That's not my manuscript."
"Yes, Mr. Galahad."
"Take it back," said the author, with pardonable peevishness. "I don't want it. Good Lord, I came out here to forget it."
He broke off, mystified. A strange, pop-eyed expression had manifested itself on the butler's face, and his swelling waistcoat was beginning to quiver faintly. The Honourable Galahad watched these phenomena with interest and curiosity.
What are you waggling your tummy at me for, Beach?
I am uneasy, Mr. Galahad.
You shouldn't wear flannel vests, then, in weather like this.
Mentally uneasy, sir.
What about?
The safety of this book of yours, Mr. Galahad. The butler lowered his voice. May I inform you, sir, of what occurred a few moments ago when I proceeded to the small library to find your glasses?
What?
Just as I was about to enter, I heard movements within.
You did?
The Honorable Galahad clicked his tongue.
I wish to goodness people would keep out of that room. They know I use it as my private study.
Precisely, Mr. Galahad. Nobody has any business there while you are in residence at the castle. That is an understood thing. And it was for that reason that I immediately found myself entertaining suspicions.
Eh? Suspicions? How do you mean?
That some person was attempting to purloin the material which you have written, sir.
What?
Yes, Mr. Galahad. And I was right. I paused for an instant, said the butler impressively, and then flung the door open sharply and without warning.
Sir, there was Mr. Pilbeam standing with his hand in the open drawer. Pilbeam?
Yes, Mr. Galahad.
Good gad.
Yes, Mr. Galahad.
What did you say?
Nothing, Mr. Galahad. I looked.
What did he say?
Nothing, Mr. Galahad. He smiled.
Smiled?
In a weak, guilty manner.
And then?
Still without speaking, I proceeded to the desk, secured the written material, and started to leave the room. At the door I paused and gave him a cold glance. I then withdrew.
Splendid, Beach.
Thank you, Mr. Galahad.
You're sure he was trying to steal the thing?
The papers were actually in his grasp, sir.
He couldn't have just been looking for notepaper or something.
A man of Beach's build could not look like Sherlock Holmes listening to fatuous theories from Dr. Watson, nor could a man of his position, conversing with a social superior, answer as Holmes would have done. The word tush may have trembled on his lips, but it got no farther. No, sir, he said briefly.
But his motive? What possible motive could this extraordinary little perisher have for wanting to steal my book?
A certain embarrassment seemed to grip Beach. He hesitated. Might I take a liberty, Mr. Galahad?
Don't talk rot, Beach. Liberty? I never heard such nonsense. Why, we've known each other since we were kids of 40.
Thank you, Mr. Galahad. Then, if I may speak freely, I should like to recapitulate briefly the peculiar circumstances connected with this book. In the first place, may I say that I am aware of its extreme importance as a factor in the affairs of Mr. Ronald and Miss Brown. The Honorable Galahad gave a little jump. He had always known the butler as a man who kept his eyes open and his ears pricked up, and informed himself sooner or later of most things that happened at the castle, but he had not realized that his secret service system was quite so efficient as this. In order to overcome the opposition of her ladyship to the union of Mr. Ronald and Miss Brown, you expressed your willingness to refrain from giving this volume of reminiscences into the printer's hands, her ladyship being hostile to its publication, owing to the fact that in her opinion its contents might give offence to many of her friends, notably Sir Gregory Parslow. Am I not correct, Mr. Galahad?
Quite right.
Your motive in making this concession being that you were apprehensive lest, without this check upon her actions, her ladyship might possibly persuade his lordship to refuse to countenance the match.
Possibly is good. You needn't be coy, Beach. This meeting is tiled. No reporters present. We can take our hair down and tell each other our right names. What you actually mean is that my brother Clarence is as weak as water, and that if it wasn't for this book of mine, there would be nothing to stop my sister Constance nagging him into a state where he would agree to forbid a dozen weddings just for the sake of peace and quiet.
Exactly, Mr. Galahad. I would not have ventured to put the matter into precisely those words myself. But since you have done so, I feel free to point out that, the circumstances being as you have outlined, it would be very agreeable to her ladyship were this manuscript to be stolen and destroyed. The Honorable Galahad sat up, electrified.
Beach, you've hit it. That fella Pilbeam was working for Connie.
The evidence would certainly appear to point in that direction, Mr. Galahad.
Probably Parslow sitting in with them.
I feel convinced of it, Mr. Galahad. I may mention that on the night of our last dinner party, her ladyship instructed me with considerable agitation to summon Sir Gregory to the castle by telephone for an urgent conference.
Her ladyship and Sir Gregory were closeted in the library for some little time, and then Sir Gregory emerged, obviously labouring under considerable excitement, and a few moments later I observed him talking to Mr. Pilbeam very earnestly in a secluded corner of the hall.
"Giving him his riding orders?"
"Precisely, Mr. Galahad. Plotting. The significance of the incident eluded me at the time, but I am now convinced that that was what was transpiring." The Honourable Galahad rose.
"Beach," he observed with emotion, "I've said it before, and I say it again. You're worth your weight in gold. You've saved the situation. You have preserved the happiness of two young lives, Beach."
"It's very kind of you to say so, sir."
"I do say so. It's no use our kidding ourselves. With that manuscript out of the way, those two wouldn't have a dog's chance of getting married. I know Clarence. Capital fella. Nobody I'm fonder of in the world, but constitutionally incapable of standing up against arguing women. We must take steps immediately to ensure the safety of this manuscript, Beach."
"I was about to suggest, Mr. Galahad, that it might be advisable if in future you were to lock the drawer in which you keep it." The Honourable Galahad shook his head.
"That's no good. You don't suppose a determined woman like my sister Constance, aided and abetted by this ghastly little weasel of a detective, is going to be stopped by a locked drawer? No, we must think of something better than that. I've got it. You must take the thing, Beach, and keep it in some safe place. In your pantry, for instance."
"But Mr. Galahad..."
"Now what?
Suppose her ladyship were to learn that the papers were in my possession and were to request me to hand them to her. It would precipitate a situation of considerable delicacy were I to meet such a demand with a flat refusal."
"How on earth is she to know you've got it? She doesn't ever drop into your pantry for a chat, does she?"
"Certainly not, Mr. Galahad," said the butler, shuddering at the horrid vision the words called up.
"And at night you could sleep with it under your pillow. No risk of Lady Constance coming to tuck you up in bed, what?"
This time, Beach's emotion was such that he could merely shudder silently.
"It's the only plan," said the Honourable Galahad with decision. "I don't want any argument. You take this manuscript and you put it away somewhere where it'll be safe. Be a man, Beach."
"Very good, Mr. Galahad.
Do it now."
"Very good, Mr. Galahad.
And naturally not a word to a soul."
"Very good, Mr. Galahad." Beach walked slowly away across the lawn. His head was bowed, his heart heavy. It was a moment when a butler of spirit should have worn something of the gallant air of a soldier commissioned to carry dispatches through the enemy's lines. Beach did not look like that. He resembled far more nearly in his general demeanour one of those unfortunate gentlemen in railway station waiting rooms who, having injudiciously consented at 4:30 to hold a baby for a strange woman, look at the clock and see that it is now 6:15 and no relief in sight. Dusk was closing down on the forbidding day. Sue, looking out over her battlements, became conscious of an added touch of the sinister in the view beneath her. It was the hour when ghouls are abroad, and there seemed no reason why such ghouls should not decide to pay a visit to this roof on which she stood. She came to the conclusion that she had been here long enough. Eerie little noises were chuckling through the world, and somewhere in the distance an owl had begun to utter its ominous cry. She yearned for her cozy bedroom, with the lights turned on and something to read till dressing for dinner time. It was very dark on the stone stairs, and they rang unpleasantly under her feet. Nevertheless, though considering it probable that at any moment an icy hand would come out from nowhere and touch her face, she braved the descent. Her relief as her groping fingers touched the comforting solidity of the door was short-lived. It gave way a moment later to the helpless panic of the human being trapped. The door was locked. She scurried back up the stairs onto the roof, where at least there was light to help her cope with this disaster. She remembered now. Half an hour before, a footman had come up and hauled down the flag which during the day floated over Blandings Castle. He had not seen her, and it had not occurred to her to reveal her presence. But she wished now that she had done so, for, supposing the roof empty, he had evidently completed his evening ritual by locking up. Something brushed against Sue's cheek. It was not actually a ghoul, but it was a bat, and bats are bad enough in the gloaming of a haunted day. She uttered a sharp scream, and doing so, discovered that she had unwittingly hit upon the correct procedure for girls marooned on roofs. She hurried to the battlements and began calling, "Hi!" in a small, hushed voice at first, for nothing sounds sillier than the word "hi" when thrown into the void with no definite objective. Then more loudly. Presently, warming to her work, she was producing quite a respectable volume of sound. So respectable that Ronnie Fish, smoking moodily in the garden, became aware that there were voices in the night, and after listening for a few moments, gathered that they proceeded from the castle roof. He made his way to the path that skirted the walls.
"Who's that?"
"Oh, Ronnie."
For 2 days and two nights, grey doubts and black cares had been gnawing at the vitals of Ronald Fish. The poison had not ceased to work in his veins. For 2 days and two nights, he had been thinking of Sue and of Monte Bodkin. Every time he thought of Sue, it was an agony. And every time his reluctant mind turned to the contemplation of Monte Bodkin, it was anguish. But at the sound of that voice, his heart gave an involuntary leap. She might have transferred her affections to Monte Bodkin, but her voice still remained the most musical sound on earth.
"Ronnie, I can't get down."
"Are you on the roof?"
"Yes, and they've locked the door."
"I'll get the key."
And at long last she heard the clang of the lock, and he appeared at the head of the stairs. His manner, she noted with distress, was still Eton, still Cambridge. Nobody could have been politer.
"Nuisance, getting locked in like that."
"Yes."
"Been up here long?"
"All the afternoon."
"Nice place on a fine day."
"I suppose so."
"Though hot."
"Yes."
There was a pause. The heavy air pressed down upon them. In the garden, the owl was still hooting.
"When did you get back?" asked Sue.
"About an hour ago."
"I didn't hear you."
"I didn't come to the front. I went straight round to the stables. Dropped Mother at the vicarage."
"Yes?"
"She wanted to have a talk with the vicar."
"I see."
"You've not met the vicar, have you?"
"Not yet."
"His name's Fosbury."
"Oh."
Silence fell again. Ronnie's eyes were roaming about the roof. He took a step forward, stooped, and picked up something. It was a slouch hat. He hummed a little under his breath.
"Monty been up here with you?"
"Yes."
Ronnie hummed another bar or two.
"Nice chap," he said. "Let's go down, shall we?"